You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
This is my responsibility to keep Terminus running.
Now, what about Terminus?
We need your help. You know about Terminus.
This is Terminus! Where all the Mazzers come to die! We're on a leper ship! We're all going to die!
Whoa, Nelly!
Whoa, hang on. This is not a leper colony. It's a podcast. Let's try this again. Welcome to the newest episode of the Terminus Podcast, coming to you from the old city of Terminus itself, Atlanta, Georgia. My name is Nicole Mazza, and I'll be your host for this podcast. Enjoy the ride! No, your ears are not deceiving you. I'm actually finally back. So yeah, hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Terminus. A very long overdue episode, no less. Sorry. Oh, and feel free to skip this introduction, by the way, and go on to the Happy Fandom Time or episode review segments, as I'm about to talk a little bit about feels. And my podcasting neuroses and such. And you might be a bit bored by that, or whatever. You do you. Anyway, yes, I know it's been a while again. Not sure if any of you care, but some of the delay has been due to all of the epic insanity of last year, with all the surgeries and health stuff, and unfortunately, this year started off pretty rough as well. So now, well into March, I've been really trying to work on all the things that I've been so behind on for the last year or so. As so much stuff in my life was mostly put on hold during all that chaos, especially like household stuff. And so yeah, tackling all of that huge to-do list has kind of been a lot of work. And that's just on the physical side of things. On the more mental and psychological side of things, full disclosure, I have to confess that one big thing that's also kept me from recording my reviews for the remainder of Series 10 was worries about just being too out of step with the rest of fandom. Much like when you're an introvert waiting for your time to speak in a group of extroverts, but the conversation moves on before you get a word in, and so you feel super awkward about talking about any topics that might have already passed. Trust me, that happens a lot. And so yeah, similarly, Doctor Who fandom has moved on in this case, at least as far as Series 10 is concerned. And now, it's really all about the 13th Doctor coming on board, or about people still mourning Capaldi leaving. Which is definitely me. Anyway, so then I have to ask myself, do I still have something that I want to personally talk about in those episodes in Series 10? Even if I'm way out of date in doing so. And you know what? I have to admit that, yeah, I do. And so, yeah, maybe what I want to say isn't earth-shattering or world-changing, but it's my thoughts on things, and that's what this podcast is really all about. My own perspective, whether I'm super late to the party or not. Because, you know, I'm not actually lost in a room full of extroverts when it comes to all this. And while the conversation has moved on for some, I can certainly still talk about the past in this medium, despite all the time that's passed. Because that's what most Doctor Who podcasts do. Talk about past stories from the long history of the show. Even if said past is less than a year old. So yeah, I think I'm going to try to do this again. I'm going to try to put aside my long list of neuroses and anxieties about doing this right, which, trust me, are very paralyzing for me on the worst days. And anyway, just go on and do it however I do it. And yes, I'll probably stumble again at some point. It is my way, after all. But I guess that's all part of the journey, too. And really, at the end of the day, my posting schedule doesn't need to be set in stone. I mean, I'd honestly love it to be, and kind of hope that I can streamline my process enough in the future to kind of get it there. But I also have to be honest with myself and forgiving with myself about just getting things out when I actually can. So yeah, overall, I'm just really hoping this year will be much better and much more productive for things like my own podcast content. I just really have high hopes for this being a less stressful and therefore much happier year. Anyway, enough of all of that oversharing. Speaking of the happier things in life instead...
It's happy fandom time.
State your name, rank, and intention.
The Doctor. Doctor. Fun.
So, if you follow my personal accounts on Twitter or Facebook, which anyone's welcome to do, by the way. Anyway, if you follow my personal social media accounts, you might have seen that while I've not been producing my own content for Terminus for a few months, I have actually been guesting on other podcasts a bit more recently. Now, guesting still scares me to death, to be honest, as I am painfully shy and have massive issues with social anxiety, but it's also been nice to chat with people I didn't already know, and to kind of wander a bit outside of my comfort zone, and to start to kind of get the hang of things like Skype. I mean, seriously, I'd never describe myself as a Luddite, but Skype was never something that's really been in my wheelhouse. As I've never really been the type that's into, like, real-time chatting or phoning, and I just kind of prefer things like emails and letters back in the day. So I've kind of had a bit of a learning curve so that I could teach myself the basics of Skype and such. Still not so good at some aspects, but I'm getting there. Anyway, some of my recent podcast experiences have been ones such as me with the guys over at the podcast Discussing who I've been recently getting to know and hope to actually meet at Wholanta this year. Anyway, first, I did an interview-style podcast with them back in October, I think it was, and it was all about my life as a Doctor Who fan, which was a lot of fun and definitely kind of novel, as I'm not sure I've ever been interviewed before that. And then this past month, while they're in the middle of a rewatch of the new series from the beginning, they asked me back, and so I was on their episodes for the Moffat two-parter, The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances, which honestly is pretty much the only story I rewatched from series one. I know, savage! But that's a whole other podcast episode. Anyway, definitely check out my two guest appearances if you want my views on that story, the Ninth Doctor, Rose, Captain Jack's first appearance, etc. Links in the show notes, of course. Next up, I was a guest on a newer podcast called Who & Company. Now, I'd met one of the hosts, Brent, online and already sort of knew him from his turn on the Quest is a Quest podcast and sort of knew the other host, Drew, from seeing him guesting on the Earth Station Who podcast. Anyway, they have a really interesting take on their Doctor Who podcast, as their guests are usually from the world of Doctor Who, either fans or actual production people, and they not only talk about their relationship to Doctor Who, but they also pick another show to be fanish about, and so the back half of the show is usually talking about that. So for example, there's like Jamie Matheson talking about his love of Sapphire and Steel, which, oh my god, had me flailing, because god, I love that show. Or, like Radio Free Scurro's Stephen Schepansky chatting about Star Cops and the tripods. Or even Jeremy Raddick, who played Gareth the security guard in the TV movie, chatting about The Prisoner, which also made me super excited. But anyway, just on and on. Now, admittedly, it was so hard to choose a show to talk about myself. I sort of went back and forth between The Tomorrow People, the original classic series, that is. As I probably wouldn't be here doing this podcast right now without that show, as it was kind of my gateway drug into Doctor Who fandom. Anyway, it was between that, my childhood love, Children of the Stones, and finally a newer favorite of mine, In the Flesh from 2013. So I decided to go with the latter, as I feel I'm a bit of an evangelist for that show, and I kind of wanted more people to know about it. So if you want to hear me geek out about In the Flesh as well as Doctor Who, go check it out. Again, the link is in the show notes. And finally, just before the holiday, I was a guest on the In Defensa podcast, which technically isn't a Doctor Who podcast per se, but is run by the big Whovians Keir Hansen from the Gallifrey Public Radio podcast and Alyssa Franke from things like Whovian Feminism or the This Week in Time Travel podcast. Anyway, they did something called the Geek Glad Game, where both them and a guest, which in this case was me, pick things that made them happy about the geek world that year. Sort of like a great big happy fandom time, but this time specifically for 2017. Anyway, so yeah, I was on there talking about not only Doctor Who, but also other geeky things that had thrilled me last year. And admittedly, I think I was hella awkward and shy, and oh god, I really cringed mightily when I listened back, but oh yeah. I hope I didn't make too terrible of a first impression, but I still think you guys might enjoy it. Or at least enjoy Kieran and Alyssa, who were much more confidently spoken than I was. Still, it was a great time at the end of the day, and really nice to celebrate some of the wonderful things going on in our various fandoms, so definitely check the show notes out for a link if you're interested. But yeah, to any podcasters out there, I'm often available to chat about Doctor Who with people, depending on scheduling, of course, and love even chatting about the classic series, which I've seen all of, well, what's available, that is. And I especially love chatting about anything from the Seventh Doctor era, which is my total favorite, and I will really go on and on and on about that. So, just warning you. And hey, I might be a bit shy and I might stumble a bit sometimes with tech like Skype and recording stuff live with multiple people, which is all still pretty new for me, but I don't know. Hit me up or something if you're interested. Anyway, speaking of my love for the Seventh Doctor era, recently there was this absolutely gorgeous complete Seventh Doctor era DVD box set that was put out by a German company for a limited time. And is sadly no longer available. Anyway, I totally wanted to get it, of course, but couldn't really afford the price tag at 150 euros, which equals about $185 from what I could tell. But they did have a contest where they were giving one away, autographed by Andrew Cartmell, no less. And so, of course, I had to enter that. Anyway, sadly, I did not win first prize, but much to my delight and surprise, I was a runner-up, and I was so happy about that, as I rarely win any contests. Anyway, what I won was a 2018 Target artwork calendar with artwork by Andrew Skilleter, which you can buy for yourself as well, by the way. I'll put a link in the show notes if you're interested. Anyway, one thing that makes that prize particularly happy-making for me is that I've been buying vintage Skilleter Doctor Who calendars for the last few years to use as modern calendars, as they match more current years since calendars repeat and all that, such as me using the 1988 one for 2016 or the 1989 one for 2017. Anyway, I also wanted to get a 1990 one for this year, but was actually unable to, so I suppose this is kind of a surprise compromise from the universe for me, since I wasn't able to get one. And yeah, obviously it's not exactly the same thing, of course, as it's intentionally a 2018 calendar, but the artwork is Skilleter's Target stuff, so yeah, for me that's awesome. And hopefully they keep publishing new Target calendars, as I'm not sure there were any Doctor Who calendars made past 1990, or at least until the new series came along, at least from what I can tell. If you know any different, definitely ping me on that, as I'd love more vintage calendars to use, if they're available for years post-1990, of course. It just brings an extra bit of delight and nostalgia to my days. Oh, and also speaking of the Seventh Doctor, it's been announced that the upcoming Doctor Who miniseries from Titan Comics will not only be featuring the Seventh Doctor, but they will be written by Andrew Cartmell and Ben Aronovitch. Oh my god! My biggest Doctor Who hero and one of my all-time favorite Doctor Who writers. So much squee!
Oh, a mission to squee!
So yeah, apparently, according to IO9, it's set to be a 3-part miniseries where we'll see, quote, the titular Time Lord and his steadfast companion Ace, played by Sophie Aldred on the show, face a mysterious alien threat that has entered the Earth's orbit, a spate of attacks on astronauts, and even aliens showing up in the Australian interior. And yeah, I'll be sure to include a link to the IO9 article about the series in my show notes, because you can not only read a little more about the series, but even better, you can see some of the beautiful cover art that's going to be on the comics. Oh, and the first issue is set to hit stores in June of 2018. So yeah, I can't wait. Oh, and speaking of the Seventh Doctor again, because that's my life. Anyway, on the Doctor Who anniversary back in November, a very new to Twitter Georgia Tennant, previously Georgia Moffat, of course, posted the most adorable picture of her posing with a cardboard stand-up of her Doctor Who character Jenny while dressed in a Seventh Doctor cosplay. And yes, that was months ago, but I'm still kind of squeeing about that, I'm not gonna lie. I love that she was even wearing the question mark vest and what looks like to be the paisley tie, both of which are available via Lavarzi, I think? So I assume she must own those, or maybe her husband David Tennant does. And how funny and awesome is it that she chose to cosplay the Seventh Doctor and not the 10th or 5th ones? I just wish I knew more of the story behind that costume. Still, Georgia being on Twitter now has, as the kids say, been a gift. She not only has shared some fun stories about the project she's working on, or has worked on, she makes fun references to David simply as the you, me, and him actor, referencing her recent film that he's in, and also shares some nice little pics and anecdotes for fans. My favorite was probably where she posted the video clip of the goodbye from both her and David to Gary Russell back when he moved to Australia a few years ago. It's an adorable little skit where David's basically playing the 10th Doctor and Georgia is, I guess she's playing herself, it's not really clear. Anyway, I'll have to dig up the link to it as I thought it was such a charming little piece and you can totally tell how much fun they had making it. So yeah, anyway, I can't wait to see what else she has in store for the Twitterverse going forward, especially as we may never have David Tennant himself on Twitter, as he basically hates social media. So this is just one lovely step beyond that, kind of by proxy, you know? And of course, Georgia's quite awesome in her own right as well, so it's cool to hear more about her. Let's see, what else? Oh yeah, coming up very soon, at least as of when I'm recording this, so it might have passed by the time this comes out. But anyway, on the 5th of April, which is the day before my birthday, by the way, a whole new book range of Doctor Who novelizations of TV episodes are coming out. And even more exciting is that they'll be in the style of the old Target novelizations, which, as you heard me squeeing earlier about the Target artwork calendar I recently won, you know is something I'm super excited about. So yeah, if you're unfamiliar, back in the classic series, Target put out novelizations of just about every one of the stories. And they were great fun, as you could not only read the story in book form of the serial you just watched, which was extra handy in case you didn't have a recording of the episode, but sometimes there are also extra bits in the books, such as going in more depth about plot points and, you know, other stuff. In short, they were awesome. Which reminds me, I need to get back to collecting all of them. I mean, I have a ton of them, but there are so many. Anyway, since the show came back in 2005, there hasn't been any Target novelizations for the new series. But now, that's changing. Well, at least on a small level at this point, as there will be 5 novelizations of new series episodes coming out in that range in April. Yes! So, for more detail, on the docket is Rose, adapted by Russell T. Davies, The Christmas Invasion, adapted by Jenny T. Colgan, The Day of the Doctor, adapted by Stephen Moffat, and Twice Upon a Time, adapted by Paul Cornell. Oh, and as a bonus for us classic series nerds, there will also be the classic Fourth Doctor and Romana 2 serial, City of Death, adapted by James Goss. So yeah, super awesome. Now, admittedly, I kind of hate the episodes Rose and the Christmas Invasion, so I won't really be in a rush to buy those two. Though, honestly, who am I kidding? I can kind of be a bit of a completist, so I'll probably get them at some point. But I do know for sure that I'll be getting Day of the Doctor, Twice Upon a Time, and City of Death, as those are awesomely awesome stories. So yeah, happy birthday to me, I guess? I might have to buy them all as a little gift to myself, depending on what the bank account looks like. Anyway, finally, the last thing on my list of happy things, which, trust me, could have been even longer, but I actually narrowed things down a bit. But, you know, it's been a while, so. Anyway, my last thing is the official Doctor Who 2018 calendar. Now, I'd heard some rumblings about it on Twitter, with fans angry at it being all a bit made of fail, with things like misattributed quotes and pictures that made no sense for particular eras, you know, etc. But I have to confess that when I saw the example with the third Doctor with a quote under it, "I only need two things, your submission and your obedience to my will," which, of course, was actually spoken by the Delgado Master and the Daemons, and not a very kinky third Doctor. Anyway, I just knew I had to have this calendar in my life. I mean, yes, of course, they really needed someone to essentially fact-check the thing, but even though it's all kinds of wrong, it also totally makes me laugh and how cracky it is. And frankly, that's kind of what I need right now, especially with how dark things have been in the outside world as of late. So yeah, give me a kinky doctor in my calendar, or companions or monsters being paired with the wrong doctors. It's all a big laugh and lots of fanish fun for me personally, especially the kinky doctor, because, well, yeah. Anyway, I'll put a link to the calendar in the show notes if anyone cares, even if I know it's probably very much not a happy thing for many of you guys, which is fine, of course. I mean, as I say, you do you, and I'll do me, and Toppy Kinky Doctor will do whoever he wants. Preferably the Delgado Master. Anyway, enough of all that, as now it's just about time for me to move on to my really belated review of the episode Oxygen. But first, here's a quick break.
Okay, let's talk about the Flopcast.
Where every week we drink a lot of coffee and we talk about comic books,
movies,
conventions,
music,
Saturday morning cartoons.
Oh, don't forget the coffee.
Lots of weird, obscure pop culture stuff from the 70s and 80s.
And chickens. Yeah, chickens.
This will be the stupidest half hour of your week.
We guarantee it.
You can find us on the ESO Network.
And Flopcast.net.
This is Andrew Cartmell, and my master plan is to get you to listen to the Terminus Doctor Who podcast.
Crew of 40. Four survivors. One distress call.
That means there's 36 corpses walking about this station. Who are you?
I'm the Doctor. I will save all your lives, and when I do, you'll be wondering who I was.
Doctor Who on BBC One.
All right, now to jump into my review and thoughts on Oxygen. And as per usual, I'll probably jump a bit around on things. I mean, I tried grouping related things together in my notes, but I'm really good, or really bad, some might say, at going off on tangents or stuff. So we'll just see how this all shakes out. Oh, and most importantly, unlike how I was doing things before, there may actually be spoilers for later episodes in Series 10. I was going to try to approach this review without doing that, kind of like I hadn't seen the other episodes yet, but it was kind of taking a lot of mental gymnastics that I frankly just wasn't quite up for, so I decided to just not worry about it. So if you've not seen the rest of Series 10 for whatever reason, you might just want to revisit this review later. I can't promise there's going to be any spoilers or not going to be any spoilers, but I just kind of wanted to give a blanket warning about that. So anyway, on to Oxygen. So yeah, this episode was written by returning writer Jamie Matheson and is the fifth episode of Series 10. Now, Matheson is still somewhat of a new writer to Doctor Who, just joining us back in Series 8. But I think that he's already left a great mark on the series, and I've been a huge fan of his work so far, especially his Series 8 stories, Flatline and Mummy on the Orient Express, which are actually two of my favorite Doctor Who stories ever. Anyway, as for oxygen, yeah, this episode is definitely in the vein of your classic Doctor Who base under siege sort of setup, which, to be honest, I do have a little bit of a penchant for, but then I'm a total Second Doctor era fangirl, so kind of makes sense. Anyway, yeah, definitely base under siege in nature, but I also really like the elements that Matheson weaved into the tale, such as, for example, all the stuff that was kind of a bit of an homage to the zombie genre. Now, admittedly, I'm not personally super keen on zombie-style stories on the whole. I mean, I love horror movies at times, and I've seen a lot of classic zombie films, but for some reason, the whole thing with zombies never quite grabbed me or really interested me much. But I do make an exception for when the genre is used in an interesting or different kind of way, such as, say, I don't know, with the paranormal romance film Warm Bodies that's narrated by a zombie that's falling in love with a human, which I absolutely love, by the way. And with the television show In the Flesh, which used the zombie apocalypse as a backdrop to discuss some pretty intense political and social issues in our real society. And yes, as I mentioned in my Happy Fandom Time segment this episode, you can hear me gleefully talking about that show over on my recent guest spot on the Who & Company podcast, as I love it so much. Link in the show notes, of course. Anyway, but yeah, the point is, let me get back on topic. Anyway, I think that Matheson is also doing something different with the genre here, and Oxygen as well, with the dead crew members not exactly being zombies in the classic sense, but more just the dead along for the ride in the sentient spacesuits that are bent on, quote, deactivating their organic component, all per the mysterious powers that be. Which is creepy in and of itself, actually, as it definitely plays around with concepts of using the machine mind, or dry brains as we discussed back in Smile. Anyway, using that machine mind and its inherent lack of empathy to carry out the command, kill all the humans, all just as simply as the machines would carry out some other mundane task, such as moving boxes from point A to point B or whatever. And it also speaks to the value of people's lives in this society, in that the powers that be have apparently deemed that the people working at Chasm Forge, the mining station, are inefficient and thus should be eliminated and replaced, not just laid off or whatever. Which, the latter isn't great either, of course, but at least you might still live. And you know the next crew would have probably suffered the same fate had the Doctor not intervened, as likely previous crews had as well, I mean, who knows. Either way, for me, it all hits a bit close to the bone for some of the current state of social affairs in the Western world, at least in the US and UK, where people who aren't as privileged or maybe perhaps aren't contributing to society in a way that's deemed good enough by whatever powerful arbiter is setting those ridiculous goalposts are all falling through the cracks and also being eliminated to some extent. No, not always through death, fortunately, but honestly not that far from it either in some cases. I mean, not making money to keep yourself fed can be a big problem. And yeah, that's me getting a bit political again, which is honestly not something I generally like to talk about, as it can be so devastatingly depressing, but it also can be a subject that's hard to avoid in stories like this, whether I want to actually discuss it or not. Still, having said that, at the end of the day, I'm also very interested in stories about dystopian futures for whatever reason. It's just been a thing of mine since I was a little kid, really loving stories like 1984, Blade Runner, Clockwork Orange, whatever. And I mean, obviously, as terrible as I think living in a full-on dystopia would be in reality, and as much as I think it could unfortunately be a real possibility in our future, I actually really love the narrative elements of Matheson's dystopian society that's portrayed here, especially in particular things like his frightening use of the commodification of oxygen in the setting. For me, I just thought it really helped crystallize the focus on the real baddie of the story, not the suits as in the sentient spacesuits, but the suits in the colloquial context that even the Doctor references. The shadowy authority figures that are making capitalism the real bad guy here. Because yeah, this is a world where oxygen costs money, and money is likely just as much of a privilege there as it is nowadays in our own world. And so if you don't have that money in that sort of society, with this commodified oxygen, you simply can't live, literally, as we as humans obviously need oxygen to survive, And further, in the case of the crew members on the ship specifically, if you don't make enough money for those in power in what's considered a sufficient enough way, you can't live either, because you are, by their definition, literally a waste of oxygen. Yeah, really dark and powerful stuff. And again, honestly, a bit more realistic than I'd like to think about. Because yeah, the fact that this could be our real future as humans is possibly one of the scariest aspects of the story for me. But anyway, yeah, as I said, in this society, oxygen is something that's now a huge commodity. And their society is centered around it so much that, for example, we learn that oxygen is only available via the spacesuits that the crew wear, and that even each of their breaths while in those spacesuits costs money. Oh, and even the simple measurement of distance for them, at least on the space station, is something that's now measured in average breaths. Rather than in, say, meters or feet or whatever. I mean, wow. Tasker even says that your breaths are, quote, the only unit worth a damn out here. And hell, even with a situation involving, quote, unauthorized oxygen, such as after the TARDIS had filled the corridors with its own air shell, said oxygen gets automatically expelled from the station. Apparently so it's not competitive in the marketing of oxygen from this society or something. So much horror, jeez. You know, as an extension of that, it also kind of makes me wonder how oxygen is commodified back on the Earth itself, or if there's perhaps a different set of rules for space and on Earth, or if these crew members aren't even from the Earth itself in the first place, but instead from an Earth colony or something, and how that colony maybe differs from or is similar to the Earth itself. I mean, the Doctor does mention the existence of, quote, hub worlds outside of corporate control at the end when talking to Ivan and Abby about where he's going to drop them off, so one could easily assume that they possibly aren't from Earth proper, and maybe the laws about oxygen vary from colony to colony based on how those in power run things. Yeah, just some thinky thoughts about the world building in this story, I guess. I mean, I love when Doctor Who sparks my imagination and makes me want to know more of the story. And God, I really need to get back into writing fanfiction again. I miss writing what was or is called tag fics, where you sort of write a possible extension of the story, filling in more details. It's just so much fun. Anyway, another quick aside about the oxygen stuff. I did love that the spacesuits in this, or smart suits as they were called, were made by a company called Ganymede Systems. Obviously, that stood out to me as both a classics geek, as Ganymede was famously the cupbearer to the Olympian gods and a lover of Zeus's, and also as an ex-student of English back at university, because it also doubles as a Shakespeare reference, specifically for the name used for Rosalind's disguise in his play As You Like It. Now, to be honest, I couldn't really think of how either version of those Ganymedes properly tied into this story, so it's probably not any sort of direct reference to those characters, and maybe it was just Jamie using it as a cool-sounding name, but it still made me super happy anyway, damn it, because I'm a total nerd. Oh yeah, and another thing about the oxygen that I found fascinating was how Matheson used the fact that us humans use up more oxygen when we're afraid because we're breathing more quickly, all as a major plot point. Especially as the characters are stuck in a situation that's inherently rife with lots of fear. And despite that, they still have to do their best to remain as calm as they possibly can so as to not die more quickly with their limited air supply. Relax or die is even what Nardole says at some point, which, yeah, I think that whole situation would be so horrible. I mean, anyone who's been in a full-on panic, which I certainly know myself with managing a reoccurring anxiety disorder over the years. Anyway, anyone who's been in a full-on panic or anxiety attack knows that trying to stop that, to calm down, is really difficult. I mean, biologically speaking, your body's sympathetic nervous system has fully taken the reins, giving you an innate fight-or-flight response to contend with, which even shuts down or even dampens some cognitive aspects of our brains that deal with things like reason or logic. And so trying to stop that by using your intellect, yeah, it feels almost impossible when you're in the middle of it. Which, of course, can make that panic spiral even more out of control because you can't control yourself and end up a mess. or maybe even dead in the case of a lack of oxygen. So yeah, I really felt for the characters in this on that front. Trying to calm yourself and slow down your breathing in such a scary situation is really a huge obstacle. And again, makes this scenario that much more terrifying. At least to me. I mean, death by your own panic. Oh, Matheson, you do so love to tap into so many of my deepest primal fears. Oh, and one other thing related to the oxygen in this, I actually really liked from a production or Doyleist standpoint how the oxygen fields around the heads of the crew generated by their smart suits was invisible, well, unless touched. I just thought how that was so much better of a solution than, say, all the actors needing to wear actual helmets the whole time, because really, that's supposed to be very difficult to work with from things I've heard. Especially as far as things like hearing your co-stars, or the director, or even being able to see around you most of the time. I believe I even saw an interview where Matt Lucas said that when they did have the actual helmets on, he did have trouble interacting with the other actors and hearing them and such, and also things like standing in the right place on his marks, but thankfully that was minimized by them not needing to wear the helmets all the time. And speaking of the smart suits, I really like the little bit about how the suits go onto your body all by themselves while you're on the pressure pad. Customized robing, I think it was called. Yeah, I could totally use that sort of function sometimes when I'm almost too sleepy to get dressed or even undressed. Though knowing my luck, it would dress me up in something utterly appalling. Oh, and I also like that we saw the smart suits were learning throughout the story as they hunted down the crew, as scary as that was, especially since the crew had originally characterized the AI in the suits as, quote, dumb as rocks, and how they could only manage limited problem solving, but they were wrong. Yeah, that was just pretty awesome to me, but then I'm generally pretty easy for stories where the AI becomes more sentient than expected by the humans, and sometimes even then becomes a threat. Such as with the classic The Terminator, or even Kubrick's 2001 A Space Oddity with HAL. And yeah, I guess Smile earlier this season did that as well with the Vardy, but I don't know, I just don't personally think that story did it as well, or at least as compellingly, as perhaps it could have done, or how well it was done in a story like Oxygen. Yeah, I guess that Matheson is just probably much more skilled at writing Doctor Who stories than Frank Cottrell Boyce has shown himself to be. Ooh, shots fired! Anyway, let's see. Some other things about the story I wanted to comment on are, here are some of the things I have specifically about the Doctor in my notes. And again, I'm probably going to jump around a bit. Anyway, first I really love the Doctor's lecture about space at the beginning, especially with the geeky Star Trek references with space, the final frontier. Plus, to be honest, all that stuff the Doctor talks about with how space can kill you, with things like lack of pressure and all that, it's all just super scary to me. I mean, to be honest, I've dreamt of going to the stars since I was a little kid, but I also really hesitate about it when I think about the possibility of dying in space, somehow being stuck out there with a failing spacesuit or whatever, or just running out of air, or being exposed to space itself, and then just dying. Yeah, that scares the shit out of me. So yeah, hopefully there won't be any sort of compulsory trip into space for me in my lifetime. Because yeah, nightmare fuel! Oh, and speaking of dying, I did really love the skull that the Doctor drew on the chalkboard during the lecture. Very nice touch. But yeah, in this story, apparently the Doctor is missing traveling in space. Like, a lot. And Nardole is not too happy about that, and is, of course, nagging him about the fact that he's supposed to stay there at the university guarding the vault instead. And yeah, admittedly, it's the Doctor who gave Nardole the instructions to keep him there, but I don't know, it doesn't make it any less annoying that Nardole is always having a go at him about it. At least for me. But then I'm pretty much universally more predisposed toward the Doctor than to Nardole anyway. Even if it's true that the Doctor is being rather unreasonable in this situation. Anyway, despite all this, soon the Doctor tries to sneak away to space with Bill, but unfortunately Nardole catches him first. Now, of course, the Doctor had tried to send him away to Birmingham as a distraction, but Nardole saw through things. And he even says that he removed Fluid Link K-57 from the TARDIS recently in order to stop the Doctor from going away. And yes, a Fluid Link's reference. I squeed so hard. If you're unfamiliar, that's a reference to the first Dalek story way back with the first Doctor in 1963 called The Daleks, or sometimes The Mutants, or even The Dead Planet. Yeah, it's complicated, but suffice it to say, I think most people just call it The Daleks nowadays. Anyway, that reference made me super happy, and I laughed mightily when stealing the Fluid Link then actually failed to keep the TARDIS from leaving. Oh, Doctor, you're just so mischievous. I also really liked the whole bit with the Doctor telling Nardole and Bill that the distress call that they were hearing on the TARDIS was his theme tune, and how, quote, "you only really see the true face of the universe when it's asking for your help," which is actually reiterated later when the Team TARDIS encounter the first dead zombie crew member, because of course said crew member just totally freaks out Bill and Nardole, and they both want to immediately leave in the TARDIS, but the Doctor stops them, repeating his earlier sentiment with, quote, "four survivors, one distress call. The universe shows its true face when it asks for help." And then he adds, "we show ours by how we respond." Yeah, I thought that was just a great little character beat there for the Doctor. I do really love how this Doctor has become someone who's so willing to try and save everyone, as that has certainly not always been the case with him or other regenerations, especially in the new series. I also really love that little bit about how the Doctor is happy that on the space station, the space doors are of classic design, as they have pressure seals and hinges. And then he disagrees with Nardole about whether they should instead make the sound, specifically shh-shh, instead. Now, Nardole prefers shh-shh for whatever it's worth, but I think I'm definitely again Team Doctor in this particular argument. Not a surprise, as I kind of hate Nardole. Anyway, let's see. Oh, I also really loved Capaldi's sort of moan groan of despair when the first zombie they encountered just straight up destroyed his sonic screwdriver. Seriously, that was a gift.
Oh.
Just so perfect. God, I love Capaldi. And all of that took the sonic out of play for the story, which was also awesome. I mean, I love the sonic screwdriver, don't get me wrong, but I feel like sometimes, especially in the new series, the Doctor can be a bit over-reliant on it. And, well, I grew up more in 80s Doctor Who, where the sonic was either not used at all, or its use was generally minimized, and, you know, I kind of love that. Plus, Jamie Matheson said at Wholanta last year how much he likes doing things like that in the narrative, much like he's done also with the TARDIS in his stories. All of that just in order to challenge the Doctor more. Plus, yeah, either way, seriously, the Doctor has plenty of other sonics on his desk back at school, so he should be fine. And he also has the sonic sunglasses as well. And speaking of the sonic shades, they actually make a bit of a return at the end of the story, as the Doctor had a tiny bit of an incident that led to him, being blind. Which I'll probably go into more in a few minutes when I zero in on the Doctor and Bill relationship in this story. But yeah, as far as that blindness was concerned, despite the Doctor's claims that he apparently, quote, has stuff in the TARDIS that'll cure anything, it was interesting to see that when Nardole tries to restore the Doctor's vision at the end of the story, it actually fails. Now, I have to confess, I personally thought the Doctor would have been a bit alright out in space, at least for a short time, as I thought that the Time Lords could supposedly survive in a vacuum much longer than humans. I mean, for example, I remember that being a thing in the classic series story Four to Doomsday with the Fifth Doctor.
I want to announce my presence!
Now, in that particular serial, we get treated to an admittedly rather goofy spacewalk by Fivey, where, in contrast to Oxygen, instead he survives wearing little more than a somewhat silly-looking helmet, all after being propelled along in space by using the physics of a cricket ball bouncing back to him, I think. It's been a while since I watched that story. Anyway, but yeah, the point is that the Doctor seemed all right in space in the past, and hell, I even thought maybe his respiratory bypass system might have helped as well. But I guess in this story, it's not about breathing or whatever in space, but about the lack of pressure instead, as the Doctor said in the beginning. And so I guess the lack of pressure is what blinded him? Or something? I don't even know. Anyway, whatever. As I was saying before, Nardole thinks he actually fixes the Doctor's eyes at the end. And for the Doctor's part, the Doctor actually pretends, for whatever reason, that Nardole was successful. Which I have to say that I think was all super weird, personally. The lying, I mean. But again, whatever. Oh, and from a behind-the-scenes Doyleist perspective, apparently in the original version of the script, the Doctor was actually cured at the end, but then Stephen Moffat thought it would be cool to continue the blindness onto at least one more story instead. Which, again, certainly left me surprised. But I'm also kind of glad they continued the whole thing in a way, as it nicely showed some concrete consequences for the risks that the Doctor takes on his adventures. Something which I personally don't think we see enough of in the show. Anyway, one small thing about the blindness, again from a Doyleist or performing standpoint, I've always found it interesting on rewatch to look closely at how Capaldi plays that scene near the end in the TARDIS, the one where the Doctor is pretending to be sighted while still blind. Now, it's all very subtle in his performance, but if you watch closely, you can totally tell that Capaldi is playing it as the Doctor still being blind. Like, he doesn't really look at people when they're talking to him or whatever, but you really have to be paying attention to even see it. I just thought that was very excellent acting, as always, from Capaldi there. And finally, about the Doctor's blindness, and I think it was the Australian aftershow Whovians where I think I heard someone say this, but I also agree with them with how this was a perfect opportunity to bring back K-9 in the show, specifically to act as the Doctor's seeing eye dog. Yeah, that would be so awesome. I mean, to be fair, any excuse for K-9 to return is good enough for me. God, I love K-9. I don't even care what anyone says. Anyway, onto my notes specifically about just Bill, and there aren't much, as I mostly have notes about her with the Doctor, but I do have to admit that one bit I really loved was Bill's whole racism exchange with Darren. That was just classic, especially when he was all like, great, we rescued a racist because of her reactions to him. And I love how when Bill tries to repair the encounter, mentioning how she's usually the one on the receiving end of racism instead, Darren just can't understand why Bill would experience any racism herself. Yeah, I don't know. I just thought that was a nice little moment that really showed how cultural perceptions of things like race can really change over time. I mean, yes, there's always going to be things that people are prejudiced about, unfortunately. But what that is exactly, yeah, that's a bit fluid. Anyway, let's see. Oh, I also really like at the beginning when the Doctor wants to take Bill on the trip and asks her to pick a place. And so she asks if there's any reviews she could check out for the places that they could visit. She says, quote, you know, like for restaurants. Waiter was a bit handsy. Lasagna gave me the trots. 2 stars. God, I love that question. I mean, just another great point from Bill. Oh, and finally about Bill, God, this is a little thing, but I just really love her laugh toward the beginning when the Doctor's able to work the TARDIS despite Nardole taking the fluid link and it begins to dematerialize, surprising both Nardole and her. She's just so awesome. Oh, and really quick, speaking of awesome, I also really love when Bill jumps up and down when they first arrive on the space station in order to test the artificial gravity. God, I just have so much love for her. Anyway, now on to Bill and the Doctor in this. First off, I love that despite his scary lecture about the horrors of space, the Doctor still tries to tempt Bill into a trip there with him. I mean, he plays it down a bit, of course, saying it's a bit like camping, but specifically the opposite of glamping or even well-prepared, well-managed camping in this case. In fact, he says, quote, too much between you and the outside and you might as well stay home. To feel it, you really need the space equivalent of a wafer-thin sleeping bag and a leaky 2-man tent. And yeah, by the way, on rewatch, I just thought this exchange ends up being quite a bit dark, especially considering what all they end up going through later on while on the space station. But yeah, as is so often the case with traveling with a doctor, things don't go so well. And I think that all really plays into a lot about the doctor and Bill and their relationship in this story. Such as during that super intense scene when everyone needs to escape the suit zombies and in desperation they all decide to go to another section of the space station via a dangerous spacewalk. I mean, at first there was a little humor sprinkled in, like when Bill asks what happens if she throws up in her helmet. Which, I really love the folding helmets, by the way. Anyway, but after that, just as they were all in the airlock, Bill's suit, like, totally starts to malfunction as the airlock is decompressing, which apparently can't be stopped once started. And so the doctor and the crew were all helpless to do anything about poor Bill's situation. Yeah, oh my god, I'm not gonna lie. I was just so panicked for Bill, especially as there was no time to fix her suit or helmet. And worse, the doctor, instead of comforting her, just gravely says to her that she's about to be exposed to the vacuum of space, with Nardole also reminding her not to breathe. Now, Bill's worried, and she replies that her lungs will explode if she even tries, and the doctor seems momentarily happy that she was listening to him at his lecture, but then... No time for all that, as they're now out in space! And yeah, Bill on her spacewalk with the crew was seriously one of my favorite bits, if not my actual favorite bit of the entire episode. I especially love the way they showed it from her perspective, with things like just the sound of her heartbeat or whatever, as well as just her flashing in and out of consciousness. It honestly reminded me a bit of when I was struggling to wake up from the anesthesia of my recent surgery, with me being just totally out of it, going in and out of consciousness. Though in my case, with much more oxygen and much less zombies and space fights. At least from what I remember. I mean, I could be wrong. Now that would have been interesting. Maybe my anesthesiology tech just fought all the zombies off. But yeah, anyway, such a simple and effective scene with Bill in space. And yeah, I know some people didn't like that bit, apparently, but personally, I loved it. And oh my god, then we learn that the doctor hacked Bill's suit and then gave Bill his own helmet while they were out in space. I mean, yes, it blinded him in the end, and that certainly wasn't great, but it was just so... Damn if that wasn't pretty romantic. I mean, yeah, I know Bill doesn't swing that way, but yeah, wow, that was quite a lovely sacrifice. And again, really shows just how much the doctor really, really cares about Bill and her safety. And to me, it's sort of like Ten carrying Martha through the hospital back in Smith and Jones, which, as you may recall if you listened to that episode, is truly one of my favorite things ever. Yeah, all super awesome and super sexy. And so yeah, now the doctor has to deal with being blind in this adventure after putting himself on the line for Bill, even if he is quite a bit cocky about it, such as when he jokes with Bill how he has, quote, no TARDIS, no Sonic, about 10 minutes of oxygen left, and now I'm blind. Can you imagine how unbearable I'm going to be when I pull this off? And speaking of jokes, I really love that bit where you get Bill chastising the doctor for always making jokes to distract her from things when they're in danger, because it totally comes back in the most heart-wrenching way when the doctor won't tell her a joke when she later thinks she's actually gonna die. Oh my god, this scene was so intense. Because later on, of course, Bill's suit isn't cooperating again when the suit zombies are again after everyone. And so everyone tries to pick her up to carry her with them, but the suit stops them, warning them it's an illegal maneuver to do, and therefore keeps her locked to the ground via her magnetic boots, kind of thwarting them all by health and safety rules. Yeah, so terrible. By the way, on a lighter note in that scene, I do really love when Velma, the suit Bill is wearing, then warns them that they could be fined for tampering with the operation of the suit, and poor Bill exclaims, "Oh great, I'll get fined for dying." Poor Bill, she just really goes through it in this episode. But anyway, back to the horror, you then get the bit where the doctor asks Bill if she trusts him, and how they're actually going to leave her there, and how the doctor says she's not gonna die, but it won't be good, and that, quote, "You will go through hell, but you will come through it, and I'll be waiting on the other side." Oh my heart. And then, as I said, after all that, Bill asks him to tell her a joke before he leaves to calm her, but instead he just leaves quietly with everyone else to escape the suit zombies that are quickly approaching. And all that leaving Bill totally freaking out and calling out for her mother. And then, a suit zombie approaches and touches Bill's suit, rendering her unconscious, all the while she's thinking of her mother. And Velma just sweetly says, "Please remain calm while your central nervous system is disabled. Your life is in our hands." Oh my god. Definitely, again, much like with her recent spacewalk, I was super worried about Bill there. Matheson! But of course, thankfully, Bill lives. Whew. Yeah, the doctor activates the oxygen in her suit at the end, and she breathes in, regaining consciousness, and all is right in the universe. He says that he noticed earlier that her suit battery was low, and thus really couldn't hit Bill with a lethal dose of electricity like it had with other dead crew members. And he even adds, quote, "I know what it takes to kill someone," which, yeah, that's a bit dark there, doctor. But yeah, Bill says, "I think I'm alive," and the doctor replies, "Yep, you do seem to be under that impression." And then Bill gives him the most adorable big hug ever, and has the most adorable smile while doing so. And then Nardole joins in, which wasn't my favorite bit, admittedly, as I loved it as just a Doctor and Bill moment. But, you know, I have to confess, I did think it was kind of cute when he just cooed, "Cuddle," while hugging both of them. Apparently that was all improvised by Matt Lucas, by the way. I believe he wasn't originally meant to even be a part of the hug, if I recall correctly. Speaking of Nardole, I guess I should chat a bit about him in this real quick, before moving on to the secondary characters. Yeah, honestly, I don't have many notes about him though, as I still mostly ignore him. Anyway, first off, Nardole is really the grumpy teenager on this trip, isn't he? Yeah, I remember those days. Even if you like the trip, you kind of can't admit it, so instead you just sulk all day. And yeah, I totally did that one day on a trip when my parents tracked me up to the Biltmore Estate in Asheville, North Carolina, like 3 hours away with no warning. I think I was around 16 or 17, and God, did I bitch and sulk all day long. I do want to go back there, by the way, though. It was actually really pretty. Anyway, yeah, the doctor asks Nardole if he's going to be like that the whole trip, and he replies that yes, he is, or at least until the doctor is back where he, quote, should be. So because of all that, we get treated to Nardole being even more annoying than usual. Blech. Really, most of my notes about him just boiled down to one line for me. Too many bits of Nardole whining, whimpering, squealing, and gurning in this episode for my liking. Blech. As an aside, I have to admit that I did kind of like when Nardole recognized the voice of Bill's smart suit interface as potentially being his ex, Velma, but that's probably because I actually really liked Velma. So yeah, I mean, I just found myself very amused by her voice the whole time. She just had so many great quotes in this story, and I just loved her interactions with the Team TARDIS. Like, for example, when she says, quote, "You look like you're trying to run. Would you like help with that?" When everyone is running from the suit zombies, or also when the Team TARDIS finally gets to the hideout with the surviving crew members, and she says, "Would you like to give feedback on your experience so far?" Yeah, toss out Nardole and keep Velma the suit instead. So much funnier. Anyway, the only other thing I have in my notes on Nardole specifically was noting him giving the doctor the big scolding at the end when they're both finally back in his office at the university. He was definitely really giving it to him, and honestly, I kind of don't blame the doctor for just saying stop talking to him a few times just to brush him off. But then I was sort of saying that in my head too, so yeah. Nardole, please stop talking, like forever. Good, thanks, bye. But then, of course, we get the cheesiest line of the episode when the doctor says very dramatically, looking right down the lens of the camera, "I can't look at anything ever again. I'm still blind." Wow. That was something. Not the finest moment of the episode, in my opinion. Anyway, enough about Misery Guts Nardole, as I still have a few notes to go about the crew themselves, who I liked way more. So yeah, anyway, as I said, the mining station that the Team TARDIS end up on is called Chasm Forge, and originally it had 40 members, but only 4 are surviving when the leads arrive. And I have to say, first of all, Pretty Crew is super pretty, especially Ivan. Did I mention that before? I don't know, but yeah, there were some really good-looking actors playing those crew members. Almost like a CW show or something. I was definitely all a flutter. And yeah, Ivan was my favorite in that regard. But it's not like the others weren't super hot too. Especially like Abby. I mean, wow. And yeah, it shouldn't be so superficial. But damn. Oh, one interesting note I had regarding those actors from a production standpoint was that I learned from the TARDIS Wiki that 3 out of 5 of those guest actors had previously worked on Big Finish audios, either for Doctor Who or Bernice Summerfield. Now, Kieran Bue, who played my beloved Ivan, was in the stories The Helm of Awe with the 4th Doctor and The Lady of Mercia with the 5th Doctor. Now, Mimi and Dwenny, who played Abby, was in the Bernice Summerfield story Big Dig. And finally, Peter Caulfield, who played Darren, the blue guy, was in Cold Fusion with both the 5th and the 7th Doctor, which has a plot synopsis that sounds totally awesome, by the way. So I might need to check that one out. Does anyone out there know if it's any good? I mean, I'd love to know, as I admittedly have lots of blind spots when it comes to Big Finish. Anyway, I just thought that was cool how they'd all been in Big Finish before. Oh, and by the way, also from the TARDIS Wiki, I love how they apparently jokingly nicknamed Peter Caulfield, again, the guy who played Darren, Blue Peter on set. I mean, as an American, to be honest, I mostly only know the UK kid show Blue Peter through its longtime ties with Doctor Who, but I still appreciate the reference and, I don't know, it gave me a good laugh. Let's see. Oh, I have to say that I thought that Ellie and Ivan in space in the beginning is such a great little pre-credit sequence. I just love her telling Ivan how she wants to have a baby with him, even if he can't hear her because her spacesuit comms are malfunctioning. I mean, that's not my thing personally. Hashtag child free. But I still thought it was a sweet moment for them. Now, of course, I also kind of knew Ellie was probably a goner at that point, as is the way in many horror stories. I mean, you bare your soul and then you die. But for me, it mostly just didn't matter, as I felt the scene was just so well done overall, especially in that soon afterward, Ivan then also couldn't hear her cries for help as she was being attacked by the dead crewmen that were also on the outside of the ship. I mean, you already start things feeling a bit bad for Ellie as she's hopelessly trying and failing to communicate with Ivan when it comes to the love stuff. As if relationship talks aren't challenging enough at times. But then, right after, she's in actual trouble, calling out in terror, and everything just ramps up, and Ivan has no way of knowing she's even in danger. Wow. Poor Ellie. What a nightmare. Again, Matheson is just so freaking good at scaring me. And God, visually, I thought that scene just looked so good, too. Very creepy and surprisingly pretty realistic looking for like a simple, fairly low budget space scene. And plus, I just love that creepy synthy music as the zombie crewmen descend to attack Ellie while Ivan's not looking in their direction. God, such a great horror moment. I mean, of course we soon see after that Ivan himself has somehow survived the attack since he's inside with the rest of the crew later when the Team TARDIS get on the ship. But still, as I said, really scary stuff all around. I do remember that one thing that Matheson said back when I saw him at Hulanta was that as a writer, he personally likes to have the baddie of the story do something big and horrible, specifically in the pre-credits sequence, or at least at the beginning of the story, so that it takes some of the pressure off for the rest of the story for the audience waiting for the baddie to show up in the first place. Which, yeah, that's totally true when you look at his body of work for the show, as he did that in his previous stories too, such as The Mummy's First Kill and Mummy on the Orient Express, and that really spooky killing of the guy being trapped in the wall screaming at the beginning of Flatline, which were both before the credits. And I agree with him, it is very effective. By the way, also speaking of Jamie Matheson at Hulanta, I also remember him joking about how his wife had been teasing him for ages about him naming characters after their friends, but never any after her personally. So apparently he not only named a character after her in Oxygen, but was delighted to say that he killed her namesake as well. So I'm assuming his wife's name is Ellie? I mean, I think she's the only named female character in the story that dies. Oh, and before you go getting upset at him fictionally killing his wife, that's all apparently a part of the playful side of their relationship at work, as Jamie was sure to stress to the crowd that apparently his wife was actually very pleased with all this, so there was no doghouse for him or anything. Anyway, on to more show notes about the crew. Oh yeah, I loved how the doctor was impressed with Ivan's method of sending out the distress call. Apparently he had boosted a suit radio through the dish, and the doctor said, good job. Can pretty, pretty Ivan join Team TARDIS 2, Doctor? I do love a smart boy, and again, you can totally trade Nardole for him. Just an easy swap there. Oh, and keep Velma the suit too, of course. And hell, Abby would be really awesome to bring along too. It can be just like the old days with a big Team TARDIS, with Bill and Ivan and Abby and Velma the suit. Yeah, and Nardole can just find his own way back home or something. That would be perfect. But alas, he was not to be. Anyway, back to the crew. Oh, one quick aside. I did think that when we got to see Tasker getting killed by the touch of one of the suit zombies, it was super creepy, but also definitely effective, and I really love that. Especially since that's really the first death we properly see, as you don't really see how Ellie is killed in the beginning. And how while it's happening, the suit's voice just pleasantly says, instruction received. Organic component will be deactivated. Please remain calm while your central nervous system is disabled. Your life is in our hands. Oh my god, that is just so creepy. Oh, and I also have to note that I really loved Abby and how she just wasn't falling for the doctor's charms right away, which I admittedly appreciate from time to time. I mean, stories like Midnight take that to the extreme, of course, but I honestly don't really blame someone for being a bit suspicious of someone who just pops in out of nowhere with buckets of bravado and arrogance, expecting everyone to just follow his lead, no questions asked. I mean, yeah, as an audience member, we know the doctor's just trying to help, and that he's often pretty good at what he does, even if he stumbles through a lot of it. But in-universe? Yeah, I totally get people realistically reacting to that with sort of an attitude of, who does this guy think he is? Anyway, so yeah, I really appreciate Abby for that in this. And so I kind of end up rolling my eyes a bit when the doctor, in response to Abby's reticence, then launches into one of his trademark speeches. You know, the ones that you kind of know are just going to be a soundbite for the trailer, where he's all, quote, I'm the doctor. I will do everything in my power to save all your lives. And when I do, you will spend the rest of them wondering who I was and why I helped you. Seriously, I love the doctor, obviously. But I have to wonder, does he practice these speeches in the mirror back on the TARDIS? I mean, as I said, I adore the doctor, and especially the writing for Capaldi on the whole, but again, at times, such speeches just don't feel very organic to the plot, or even the scene they're in my opinion, and as I said, feel almost nothing more than trailer fodder. And this speech, in Oxygen in particular, certainly kind of feels that way for me. And yeah, I do think Capaldi is definitely beautiful and awesome when giving said speeches, but then he could read me the phone book and I'd probably be all a flutter. But yeah, his speech here, I don't know, it just feels a bit off to me. Anyway, at least good old Abby doesn't fall for it and soon just points her blaster at him in response. She's all like, well, you didn't save Tasker, did you? And he believed you, trusted you, and now he's dead. And then, while still pointing her gun at him, she adds, can you give me a good reason why you shouldn't join him? Harsh, but perfectly played, Abby. Anyway, despite all that, soon shit gets real. Because the doctor hacks everyone's suits, well, everyone is still alive, that is, and wires their life signs into the station's coolant system. And so apparently, if they die, which he apparently intends, wanting them to have, quote, a good death, anyway, if they die, the cooling system vents, which will cause the nuclear core of the station to blow, and will just destroy everything. The Doctor says it will be one very big boom, and that it will be, quote, revenge as bright as the sun. It's revenge you can see across galaxies. Now, of course, the crew is pretty freaked out about all of this, still thinking that rescue ships are on the way, but the Doctor gives them the grave news that there were actually never any rescue ships in the first place, and that the spacesuits were killing everyone by orders from their bosses. The suits, in the colloquial sense, the Doctor says. Because the crew were deemed inefficient and were to be discarded in order for the replacements to take over. And so, in other words, they learned that their lives had no real value at all outside of what they could do for the powers that be. And so, as they were apparently failing at that duty, they were now considered worthless. Yeah, as I'm pretty sure I mentioned earlier, very dark stuff. So, in other words, capitalism is basically the big bad in this whole scenario. And so, yeah, all I honestly have to say is what my proud socialist wife so often says herself, fuck capitalism. But, of course, all is not lost here, as the best way to deal with such a baddie is to fight it at its own game. And so the Doctor posits that if the company takes the crew's lives, the company will also then lose their station and all the money associated with it and suffer their biggest loss in its history. So, of course, because of this, when the Doctor tells the zombie suits, and by proxy, the company suits, of his plans, emphasizing how the crew was, quote, too expensive to live, and now they're actually too expensive to die, the zombie suits then quickly switch tactics to save everyone instead by giving them oxygen. So awesome. I mean, really, if you know me, you know that one of my favorite bits about the Seventh Doctor's era is how often it's about taking down the government. As it's all really a bit of a punk rock era of Doctor Who. Well, oxygen really recalled that sort of thing for me, and so I was certainly very gleeful, to say the least. Anyway, back to my notes on the crew. Oh yeah, oh my god, I had to note that Zombie Ellie is the one to give Ivan more oxygen. That truly gave me all the feels, I'm not gonna lie. Oh, and I thought it was interesting that Abby even comes around to the Doctor's side in the end, but then again, I do think he earned that, which I can totally dig. She didn't offer up her support easily, but when he proved himself to her, that's when she started to trust and support him. And I totally get that, as I can really be that way myself sometimes. Anyway, so things end pretty positively for the crew that's left, sadly only Abby and Ivan in this case. And the Doctor takes him aboard the TARDIS with his own crew, Bill and Nardole. Unfortunately, he kept the latter. And he offers to take them to the safety of a hub world outside of corporate control. But no, feeling invigorated by the whole ordeal, Abby and Ivan instead want to go to the head office to make a complaint about the whole ordeal, which, as we hear later, seems to kick off a successful corporate rebellion months later, ending corporate dominance in space. Yes! Good for them! Oh, and I especially really love, with all that the Doctor says to them in response, promise you'll be loud, which is so appropriate for both them and, honestly, the times we're living in right now. Be loud, everybody! Anyway, I think it's time for me to finally tie things up and give the story a rating. And so, yeah, I know that the story had a few problems here and there. Nardole! But overall, I found it to be one of my big favorites of the season. And yes, I know that some people say I'm a little too liberal with giving perfect or high scores. I just have a lot of love to give. But anyway, despite that, I still really think I actually want to give this one a perfect score of 5 out of 5. It's had a really great rewatchability for me. I love the structure of the story and most of the plot elements. And I thought all of the characters were really very well drawn. So yeah, 5 out of 5. Fight me.
And coming soon on the next episode.
And coming up on the next episode of Terminus, I plan on reviewing what has been deemed the Monk Trilogy. Not sure if that's an official moniker or not, but it works for me. Anyway, I decided instead of doing all 3 of those episodes separately, that I'd just talk about the whole arc as one piece, which will probably be a long episode knowing me, but I'll do my best to keep it on the shorter side. So yeah, that means I'll be chatting about Extremis, Pyramid at the End of the World, and The Lie of the Land, episodes 6, 7, and 8, series 10, all in the same episode. Yep, gods help me. Oh, and I usually drop a trailer for the next story in this segment, but being that it's three different episodes, I decided to instead go looking for a fan-made trailer for all three stories, and I found one! It was made by YouTuber GallifreyForever97, and I'll try to remember to put a link to the video in the show notes. Anyway, here's an audio clip of it.
The monks have been with us from the beginning. They have been instrumental in all the advances of culture and technology.
Without hope, without witness, without reward.
Planet Earth does not consent to your help. Thank you for playing the big pyramid game. Bye-bye. See you again next week. Hopefully not.
The sending's a message.
What message?
Bring it.
We will take this world. We will rule its people. But only when we're asked. Enjoy your sight, Doctor. Now you see our world.
Doctor Who on BBC One.
So yeah, lots of stuff in the story arc. We've got mysterious monks trying to take over the Earth, fake news, false realities, a deceptive fake blind doctor, the Pope, the Vatican, a mysterious pyramid, consent issues, bad first dates, dystopian life fun times, and hell, even the return of Missy. Yeah, it's going to be a lot to unpack, but I think I'm up for the challenge. Oh, and writers-wise for the Monk trilogy, we have Extremis, penned by Moffat, The Pyramid at the End of the World, penned by Peter Harness and Stephen Moffat. Harness also wrote Kill the Moon from Series 8 and the Zygon two-parter from Series 9, by the way. Anyway, and the final story of the trilogy was The Lie of the Land, penned by Toby Whithouse, who has, of course, written lots of Doctor Who episodes for us in the past, such as School Reunion from Series 2, The Vampires of Venice from Series 5, The God Complex from Series 6, A Town Called Mercy from Series 7, yes, I'm reading, and Under the Lake, Before the Flood from Series 9. Whew! So yeah, lots of different voices to tell the story of this arc there. And so how did I think it all came together? Well, you're just gonna have to tune in for my review on my next episode to hear my thoughts. Anyway, so yeah, I hope you'll all join me soon as possible, at least, God's willing, to hear my very belated thoughts on the Monk Trilogy. So until then, I really hope you all enjoyed this episode. As I always say, please feel free to leave comments or feedback at either my Terminus Libsyn blog, Terminus email address, the Facebook pages, Twitter, etc. Links for all of those in the show notes, of course. And I know I'm always repeating myself, but seriously, I am always really happy to hear from you guys, especially when it comes to your comments and even constructive criticism. I mean, at the end of the day, I really want you to enjoy this podcast too, and so hearing feedback certainly helps with that. Plus, I just really love having dialogues with other Doctor Who fans, and it's even better if it's about what I talked about on my show. I mean, I guess it just makes me feel less like I'm just talking to only myself all the time, which is super awkward. Or, if you'd like to just support the podcast in another way, please rate and review it over at iTunes, as that really helps others find the podcast much more easily, apparently via their super sciencey algorithm, which apparently brings in more listeners, so that, I don't know, I might have more than two or three at some point. Oh, and I may even set up a Patreon at some point, but I think I kind of want to get this podcast publishing schedule much more consistent first. Plus, I honestly have no idea how Patreon works, especially from a doing my taxes point of view. Yeah, I'll have to research that. Maybe I'll just make a tip jar or something until then. I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, enough of the admin financial talk. At the end of the day, if you've been enjoying my podcast, just doing something as simple as spreading the word around to your friends about the show definitely helps. I mean, podcasting is really all about networking a lot of the time, and I know hearing about other shows from friends is often how I myself discover new shows, so it does work, especially as I try to, in turn, recommend other shows as well to people to get the word out. So it's all one big podcast love fest. Oh, and if you haven't already, also be sure to subscribe to my podcast either on iTunes or Google Play or really through any of your favorite podcatcher services, all in order to keep up with my new episodes as they come out. As you know, I'd really hate for you to miss any future episodes, especially as my publishing schedule has been so wonky recently. Anyway, thank you again to everyone who's listened today. It really, really, really means a lot. I know I say that, but it's true. Anyway, I think it's time to finally wrap this up. And so, I hope that all of you have a great one, and I will chat with you all next time.
The Terminus Podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and many other favorite podcatchers. Be sure to check us out there and subscribe to keep up with new episodes. Alonzi.
Thank you for listening to the Terminus Podcast. You can find us online at terminus.libsyn.com or on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/terminusdwpodcast or on Twitter at terminuscast or on Tumblr at terminusdwpodcast.tumblr.com. Or you can email us at terminusdwpodcast@gmail.com. Also a great big thanks to violinist Maka for use of the Their Violin Doctor Who theme. More song information is in the show notes.
Airlock decompression completed. Jettisoning pod.
Hey, who's interrupting my intro?
Is this a joke?
This is no joke, kid. This is the Earth Station DCU podcast.
No clothes from anybody. Sickening.
We're not that kind of podcast, kid. We talk DC news, comics, movies, and television.
You gotta do better than that.
We reviewed Supergirl, Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, and Arrow every week.
That a fact. How much do I owe you?
You don't owe us anything. The podcast is free.
Oh, I just heard this story in the cab, and it is all I can think about.
We are part of the ESO Network.
This is amazing.
Why, thank you. And join us every week for another edition of the Earth Station DCU. Now, can we get back to the show, please?
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.